God and foreign policy. Is China's way of thinking about the world distinctly, well, Chinese? In many senses, it is not. The lessons drawn from that history of great powers are ones many Westerners have drawn as well. Indeed, many of the people interviewed were Western scholars. It reflects the same understanding that has driven the behavior of Germany and Japan in recent years. China's dealings with the world are practical, reflecting context and interests, and its self-perception as a developing country. Despite the enormous shadow that it casts on the world, China recognizes that it is still a country with hundreds of millions of extremely poor people. Its external concerns, accordingly, have to do mostly with development. When asked about issues like human rights, some younger Chinese officials will admit that these are simply not their concerns, as if they see these as luxuries they cannot afford. No doubt the sense is enhanced by the acute realization that human rights abroad are linked with those at home. If China were to criticize the Burmese dictatorship, what would it say to its own dissidents? There are also, however, broader cultural elements in China's way of thinking about the world. One can easily exaggerate the importance of culture, using it as a facade for policies grounded in interest. But there are some real and important differences between Chinese and Western, particularly American, worldviews that are worth exploring. They begin with God. In the 2007 Pew survey, when asked whether one must believe in God to be moral, a comfortable majority of Americans, 57%, said yes. In Japan and China, however, much larger majorities said no. In China, a whopping 72%. This is a striking and unusual divergence from the norm, even in Asia. The point is not that either country is immoral. In fact, all hard evidence suggests quite the opposite. But rather that in neither country do people believe in God. This might shock many in the West, but for scholars of the subject, it is a well-known reality. East Asians do not believe that the world has a creator who laid down a set of abstract moral laws that must be followed. That is an Abrahamic or Semitic conception of God, shared by Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but quite alien to Chinese civilization. People sometimes describe China's religion as Confucianism, but Joseph Needham, an eminent scholar of Confucianism, notes that if you think of religion as the theology of a transcendent creator deity, Confucianism is simply not a religion. Confucius was a teacher, not a prophet or holy man in any sense. His writings, or the fragments of them that survive, are strikingly non-religious. He explicitly warns against thinking about the divine, instead setting out rules for acquiring knowledge, behaving ethically, maintaining social stability, and creating a well-ordered civilization. His work has more in common with the writing of Enlightenment philosophers than with religious tracts. In fact, during the Enlightenment, Confucius was hot. The Confucian classics, Needham reports, were read with avidity by all the great forerunners of the French Revolution, by Voltaire, Rousseau, D'Alembert, Diderot, etc. Between 1600 and 1649, 30 to 50 China-related titles appeared in Europe every decade, and between 1700 and 1709, 599 works on China were published. This frenzy of publications on China coincided with the aftermath of the Thirty Years' War, 1618 to 1648, when religion had led to grotesque bloodshed. Many European liberals idealized Confucianism for its basis in natural as opposed to divine law. Voltaire put it simply in his Philosophical Dictionary: "No superstitions, no absurd legends, none of those dogmas which insult reason and nature." Immanuel Kant would later call Confucius the Chinese Socrates. Leibniz, the philosopher who straddled the line between religiosity and secularism, went so far as to argue, "We need missionaries from the Chinese who might teach us the use and practice of natural religion." Early Enlightenment thinkers celebrated Confucianism for its reliance on reason rather than on divinity as a guide to human affairs. A thesis developed: while Europe might be far ahead in scientific and technological progress, China had a more advanced ethics, a superior civil organization based on merit, not patronage, and a practical philosophy, all of which successfully produced a social peace and a well-organized social hierarchy. The climax of Enlightenment sinophilia came with Voltaire's 1759 Essai sur les Mœurs, in which, according to the German scholar Thomas Fuchs, he transformed China into a political utopia and the ideal state of an enlightened absolutism. He held up the mirror of China to provoke self-critical reflection among European monarchs. In the following year, that most enlightened of monarchs, Frederick the Great, wrote his Report of Fihuhu, a series of letters from a fictitious Chinese ambassador in Europe to the Emperor of China. Frederick's purpose was to contrast the bigotry of the Catholic Church with Chinese rationality. Westerners have often found it difficult to understand the difference between the place of religion in China and its place in the West. Consider the experiences of a Portuguese missionary in the Far East, Mateo Ricci, as recounted by the great Yale historian Jonathan Spence. In his early days in China in the 1580s, Ricci, in an effort to present himself as an honored figure, shaved his head and beard and shrouded himself in the robes of a Buddhist. Only several years later did Ricci realize how misguided this was. Monks and holy men were not held in high esteem in China. He began traveling by sedan chair or hiring servants to carry him on their shoulders, as men of rank are accustomed to do, Ricci later wrote to Claudio Acquaviva, general of the Jesuits, in 1592. The name of foreigners and priests is considered so vile in China that we need this and other similar devices to show them that we are not priests as vile as their own. By 1595, Ricci had cast off the ascetic trappings of a monk, which had hindered his missionary work, and instead adopted the dress of a Confucian scholar. Ricci had at first scorned the Confucians for not believing in God, paradise, and the immortality of the soul. The Confucian school, Ricci wrote to a friend, was the true temple of the literati. But he eventually saw that even though Confucianism maintained a strictly neutral stance towards matters of God and the afterlife, it had a strong sense of ethics, morality, and justice. Like other Enlightenment figures, he came to believe that the West should learn from Confucianism. What does God have to do with foreign policy? Historically, countries influenced by Christianity and Islam have developed an impulse to spread their views and convert people to their faith. That missionary spirit is evident in the foreign policy of countries as diverse as Britain, the United States, France, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. In the case of Britain and the United States, perhaps because they have been so powerful, the Protestant sense of purpose at the core of their foreign policies has made a deep mark on global affairs. China, in contrast, may never acquire a similar sense of destiny. Simply being China and becoming a world power, in a sense, fulfills its historical purpose. It doesn't need to spread anything to anyone to vindicate itself. So when Beijing seems bloodless in its stance on human rights, it is not simply that the regime is oppressive or takes a ruthlessly realpolitik view of its interests, though that certainly plays a role. The Chinese see these issues differently, not with a set of abstract rights and wrongs, but with a sense of the practical that serves as a guiding philosophy. Western businessmen have often noted that their Chinese counterparts seem to place less stock in rules, laws, and contracts. Their sense of ethics is more situational. If a Chinese businessman or official thinks the law is an ass, to quote an Englishman, he will ignore or go around it or simply suggest making up a new contract. The veneration of an abstract idea is somewhat alien to China's practical mindset. Social relations and trust are far more important than paper commitments. Microsoft could not get Beijing to enforce its intellectual property laws for years, until the company spent time and effort developing a relationship with the government and made clear that it wanted to help develop China's economy and educational system. Once Microsoft had convinced the Chinese government of its benign intentions, those same laws began to get enforced. Few Chinese have really internalized the notion that abstract rules, laws, and contracts are more important than a situational analysis of the case at hand, which means that Chinese political and legal development is likely to take a more circuitous and complex path than one might predict. China's cultural traditions also affect its approach to negotiation. Boston University's Robert Weller argues that Chinese base their sense of cause and effect around the idea of qi energy. Qi is the stuff of feng shui and the element in the body that is manipulated by acupuncture or Chinese herbs. It is part of a broad way of understanding the structure of the world as a set of interacting forces, complexly interrelated, rather than working through a simple and linear cause and effect. It could also have an effect on foreign policy, Weller says. Such speculation can sometimes be overdone and even sound silly, but in talking to Chinese about their ways of thinking, one quickly recognizes that concepts like qi are as central to their mindset as a moral creator or free will is to Westerners. Foreign policy is driven by many universal forces, but there's no doubt that a basic worldview organizes the way people perceive, act, and react, particularly in crises. Culture, however, does not exist in a vacuum. China's past and its own DNA are shaped by its modern history, the impact of the West, communism's decimation of tradition, the resulting vacuum in Chinese spiritualism, and perhaps most of all, its recent efforts to reconcile its traditions with modernity. When you talk to Chinese economists, they don't proclaim a Confucian way to generate economic growth or curb inflation. China's central bank seems very modern, and in that sense, Western in its approach. That it does not jump when the United States asks it to revalue its currency may tell us more about nationalism than about culture. After all, when was the last time that the United States changed its economic policy because a foreign government hectored it into doing so? The Chinese have adopted Western rationalism in many areas. Some Chinese foreign policy analysts call themselves Christian Confucians, meaning not evangelical converts, but Chinese people with a Western outlook, seeking to imbue Chinese policies with a greater sense of purpose and values. Like every non-Western country, China will make up its own cultural cocktail, some parts Eastern, some parts Western, to thrive in the 21st century. Too big to hide. China's biggest problem has to do not with the particularities of its culture, but with the universalities of power. China views itself as a nation intent on rising peacefully, its behavior marked by humility, non-interference, and friendly relations with all. But many rising countries in the past have similarly believed in their own benign motives, and still ended up upsetting the system. The political scientist Robert Gilpin notes that as a nation's power increases, it will be tempted to try to increase its control over its environment. In order to increase its own security, it will try to expand its political, economic, and territorial control. It will try to change the international system in accordance with its particular set of interests. The crucial point here is that throughout history, great powers have seen themselves as having the best intentions, but being forced by necessity to act to protect their ever-expanding interests. And as the world's number two country, China will expand its interests substantially. Ultimately, China's intentions might be irrelevant. In the messy world of international politics, intentions and outcomes are not directly linked. No country was expecting a world war in 1914. It's like a market in which all companies are trying to maximize profits by raising prices. The system-wide result is exactly the opposite, a fall in prices. Similarly, in international politics, another system with no single supreme authority, the intentions of countries do not always accurately predict the outcome. Hence the Roman aphorism, "If you want peace, prepare for war." Just how peacefully China can rise will be determined by a combination of Chinese actions, other countries' reactions, and the systemic effects that this interaction produces. Given its current size, China cannot hope to slip onto the world stage unnoticed. Its search for energy and raw materials, for example, is entirely understandable. China is growing fast, consumes energy and all kinds of commodities, and needs to find steady supplies of them. Other countries buy oil, so why shouldn't Beijing do the same? The problem is size. China operates on so large a scale that it cannot help changing the nature of the game. China's perception of its interests is shifting. Men like Wu Jianmin come from an older generation of diplomats, and the younger generation is well aware of China's new power. Some China watchers worry that in time, power will go to China's head. In a delicately phrased set of warnings delivered in China in 2005, Lee Kuan Yew described his concerns not about China's current leadership or even the next generation, but about the generation after that, which will have been born in a time of stability, prosperity, and rising Chinese influence. China's youth must be made aware of the need to reassure the world that China's rise will not turn out to be a disruptive force, he said in a speech at Fudan University. Li implied that what has kept Chinese leaders humble since Deng Xiaoping is the bitter memory of Mao's mistakes, fomenting revolutions abroad, the Great Leap Forward, and the Cultural Revolution, which together resulted in the deaths of about 40 million Chinese. It is vital, Li went on, that the younger generation of Chinese, who have only lived through a period of peace and growth and have no experience of China's tumultuous past, are made aware of the mistakes China made as a result of hubris and excesses in ideology. For now, China's foreign policy remains entirely commercially focused, though that too casts its shadow. In Africa, for example, China is working to build economic ties. The continent has natural resources, particularly oil and natural gas, that China needs in order to grow. Both Beijing and African governments have welcomed new trade relations, in part because there is no colonial past or difficult history to complicate matters, and business is booming. Trade is growing around 50% a year, Chinese investments in Africa even faster. In many African countries, economic growth is at record highs, a fact that many attribute to their new connections with China. Some on the continent see the relationship as exploitative and resent China's new power, so Beijing is taking pains to demonstrate its good intentions. In November 2006, President Hu Jintao held a summit on Sino-African relations. All 48 African countries that have diplomatic ties with China attended, most of them represented by their presidents or prime ministers. It was the largest African summit ever held outside the continent. At the meeting, China promised to double aid to Africa in 2 years, provide $5 billion in loans and credit, set up a $5 billion fund to encourage further Chinese investment in Africa, cancel much of the debt owed to China, provide greater access to the Chinese market, train 15,000 African professionals, and build new hospitals and schools across the continent. Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, gushed, "China is an inspiration for all of us." What could be wrong with building such ties? Nothing, except that as China moves into Africa, it is taking up economic, political, and military space that was occupied by Britain or France or the United States. This will necessarily mean friction as each great power struggles to promote its own interests and its own conception of doing the right thing in Africa. China's interpretation of its actions is that it doesn't interfere in these countries' domestic affairs, that it is, in a sense, value neutral. But is it? Moises Naim, the editor of Foreign Policy magazine, tells a story about the Nigerian government negotiating a $5 million loan for train systems with the World Bank in 2007. The bank had insisted that the government clean up the notoriously corrupt railway bureaucracy before it approved the loan. The deal was almost done when the Chinese government stepped in and offered the Nigerian government a $9 billion loan to rebuild the entire train system with no strings, no requirements, no need for any reform. The World Bank was sent home within days. Needless to say, much of that Chinese money will go into the bank accounts of key government officials rather than toward better train service for Nigerians. Beijing has found it useful to deal directly with governments because they almost always maintain ownership of the resources that China needs. Transactions are simpler when dealing with one centralized authority, particularly if it is an outcast and has nowhere to turn but to China. So China buys platinum and iron ore from Zimbabwe and in turn sells Robert Mugabe weapons and radio jamming devices, despite a US and European Union ban, which he uses to intimidate, arrest, and kill domestic opposition. Beijing is Mugabe's most important supporter on the UN Security Council. In Sudan, China's involvement runs even deeper. It has invested $3 billion in the oil fields there since 1999. Chinese companies are the majority shareholders in the two largest oil conglomerates in the country, and China buys 65% of Sudan's oil exports. It maintains a military alliance with Sudan, and despite UN restrictions, appears to have provided arms that end up in the hands of pro-government militias in Darfur. Chinese officials often confirm that they have a close military relationship with Sudan and intend to keep it that way. Explaining his country's position, China's deputy foreign minister was frank. Business is business. We try to separate politics from business. Secondly, I think the internal situation in Sudan is an internal affair, and we are not in a position to impose upon them. If China were a bit player on the global stage, it wouldn't matter much what it was doing in Zimbabwe or Sudan. Cuba, for all we know, has extensive dealings with both governments, but no one cares. Beijing, on the other hand, cannot hide its light under the bushel anymore. China's dealings with these countries give them a lifeline, retard progress, and in the long run, perpetuate the cycle of bad regimes and social tensions that plague the African continent. This kind of relationship also ensures that while Africa's governments might view China favorably, its people will have more mixed views, as they have had of Western governments through the years. Beijing has been slow to recognize its broader responsibility in this region, arguing that it is simply minding its own business. But in fact, it isn't even doing that. Beijing has often shown itself to be well aware of its power. One reason it has focused on Africa is that the continent has long included a number of countries that have been friendly with Taiwan. Although 7 of the 26 governments in the world that have relations with Taiwan today are in Africa, 6 countries, including South Africa, have switched recognition from Taipei to Beijing over the last decade thanks to judicious offers of aid. China has been more skillful and used better diplomacy and soft power in Asia, the region where Beijing devotes the most time, energy, and attention. Through skillful diplomacy, it has helped orchestrate a revolution in attitudes over the last 2 decades. In the 1980s, China did not even have relations with much of East Asia, including South Korea, Indonesia, and Singapore. By the summer of 2007, it was holding joint military exercises with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN. When asked in polls in 2007 whom they trusted to wield global power, respondents in countries like Thailand and Indonesia, traditional U.S. allies, chose China over the United States. Even in Australia, favorable attitudes towards China and the United States are evenly balanced. Until recently, memories of China's revolutionary foreign policy, which in practice meant using the Chinese diaspora to foment trouble, lingered. Beijing's invasion of Vietnam, its claims in the South China Sea, and its border disputes with Russia and India had given China the image of a prickly and troublesome neighbor. By the late 1990s, however, China had adopted a very different regional policy, which became especially clear from its constructive role in the region after the East Asian crisis of 1997. Since then, Beijing has become remarkably adept at using its political and economic muscle in a patient, low-key, and highly effective manner. Its diplomacy now emphasizes a long-term perspective, a non-preachy attitude, and strategic decision-making that isn't bogged down by internal opposition or bureaucratic paralysis. It has taken a more accommodating political line, providing generous aid packages, often far outstripping those provided by the United States, and moved speedily on a free trade deal with ASEAN. Having long avoided multilateral associations, it has more recently gotten involved in as many as possible, even creating one of its own, the East Asian Summit, which pointedly excludes the United States. China is now welcomed by the Southeast Asian nations as well. The seemingly pro-American president of the Philippines, Gloria Arroyo, publicly proclaimed, "We are happy to have China as our big brother." This change is reflected in Beijing's relations with governments throughout its neighborhood. The Vietnamese, for instance, have no particular love for China. As one official there said to me, "We are clear-eyed. China has occupied Vietnam for 1,000 years. It has invaded us 13 times since then." But he also acknowledged, "It is a huge presence, our biggest exporter," which means that their governments and people must approach the relationship pragmatically. Bookstores I visited in Vietnam prominently displayed the collected speeches of the Chinese leaders, Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, and Hu Jintao. Before arriving in Vietnam, I had been in Tokyo during Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao's 2007 state visit, and I heard a similar refrain. Wen finessed the many points of tension between the two countries and instead accentuated the positive, their booming economic ties. This détente, however, is fragile and points to the principal danger in Beijing's foreign policy, its effort to co-opt nationalism for its own purposes. In the past, Beijing insisted on keeping relations with Japan tense. Japan's wartime atrocities and reluctance to acknowledge guilt have been a large part of the problem. But Beijing also seemed to actively cultivate tension, bringing up Japan's wartime behavior whenever convenient, refusing to accept Japanese apologies, and teaching a virulently anti-Japanese version of history in its schools. In April 2005, the Chinese government appeared to encourage anti-Japanese protests over history textbooks, only to find them mushroom into mob demonstrations, riots, stone-throwing at the Japanese embassy, and widespread calls to boycott Japanese goods. In strategic terms, assuming a peaceful rise policy, it made little sense for Beijing to be as uncompromising towards Tokyo as it was in the past. Doing so would ensure that China would have a hostile neighbor, one with a formidable military, and an economy that is still 3 times the size of China's. A wiser strategy would be to keep enmeshing Japan with economic ties and greater cooperation, gaining access to its markets, investment, and technology, and achieving dominance over time. There is even an argument for genuine reconciliation. Japan has not behaved perfectly, but it has apologized several times for wartime aggression and paid China more than $34 billion in developmental aid, reparations effectively, something never mentioned by the Chinese. And clearly, a desire for reconciliation was on display when Premier Wen went to Japan in 2007. But it might not last. For China, a domestic problem gets in the way. Having abandoned communism, the Communist Party has been using nationalism as the glue that keeps China together. And modern Chinese nationalism is defined in large part by its hostility toward Japan. Despite his many catastrophic policies, Mao remains a hero in China because he fought the Japanese and unified the country. The Chinese government has generally assumed it could manage popular sentiment, but it is losing that confidence. Not being a democracy, it has little experience doing so. It deals with public anger and emotions cagily, unsure whether to encourage them or clamp down for fear of where they might lead. It has no idea what to do with a group like the Patriots Alliance, an internet-based hyper-nationalist group that organized the anti-American protests after the 2001 EP3 plane incident and the anti-Japanese protests of 2005. Both actions were at first encouraged, only to become much more intense than the regime expected. Those incidents appear to have spurred some rethinking, and Beijing has more recently toned down its support of nationalism, more fully embracing a quieter approach to diplomacy and politics. The danger of external crisis plus internal nationalism looms largest over Taiwan. Beijing, long obsessed with Taiwan, has been uncompromising, as have some Taiwanese politicians, a sometimes combustible combination, as when President Chen Shui-bian of Taiwan provoked a flurry of outrage by proposing a national referendum on Taiwan's independence in 2002. For the most part, Beijing has pursued its long-term plan of normalizing relations with the island's main political party and smothering it with conciliation. But not always. In March 2005, Beijing passed an anti-secession law, threatening Taiwan with military force if it dared to anger China in any way. As a result, among other things, the European Union postponed its plan to lift an arms embargo on China. Taiwan offers the most vivid and important example of how the economic incentives for integration and the political urges for nationalism diverge and yet can be managed. The rational decision-making that guides economic policy is not so easily applied in the realm of politics, where honor, history, pride, and anger all play a large role. In recent years, Beijing has switched to a smarter, less aggressive course with regard to Taiwan and even with Japan, recognizing that time is on its side. Thus, it has made several clever moves that have increased Taiwan's dependence on the mainland. Most significantly, the reduction of tariffs on farm products that come from the most independence-minded parts of Taiwan. All the while, of course, China's military has grown rapidly, its principal strategic objective being to prevail quickly in any conflict over Taiwan. In other words, economic growth and globalization have made Beijing plan for integration and yet given it the power for military and political confrontation. The Dragon and the Eagle. The importance of China's relations with every country in the world is dwarfed by its relations with one, the United States of America. Or to put it differently, none of the potential problems that China faces matter unless they trigger the involvement of America. Without U.S. involvement, a war over Taiwan might be bloody and tragic, but only if it turned into a Sino-U.S. confrontation would it have far-reaching global consequences. The China challenge also has greater implications for the United States than for other countries. Historically, when the world's leading power is challenged by a rising one, the two have a difficult relationship. And while neither side will admit it publicly, both China and the United States are worried and planning for trouble. For three decades, Chinese foreign policy has been geared towards satisfying the United States for a variety of practical reasons. First, it was anti-Soviet strategy, then a desire for markets and reform, then rehabilitating the country after Tiananmen Square, membership in the World Trade Organization, and finally, the Beijing Olympics. But increasingly, China's younger elites believe that their country needs to think of itself as a competitor to Washington in several senses. In Washington, there have always been those who see China as the next comprehensive threat to American national interests and ideals. To say this is not to assume war or even conflict, but merely to note there is likely to be tension. How the two countries handle it will determine their future relations and the peace of the world. For now, the forces of integration have triumphed in both Beijing and Washington. The Chinese-American economic relationship is one of mutual dependence. China needs the American market to sell its goods. The United States needs China to finance its debt. It's globalization's equivalent of the nuclear age's mutual assured destruction. And to add to the forces of stability, the Chinese and American nuclear arsenals also act as deterrents. The reality of a globalized world forces America and China into an alliance that pure geopolitics could never countenance. As a result, the Bush administration has been strikingly accommodating to Beijing over Taiwan. George W. Bush is probably the most ideologically hostile president ever to handle U.S.-China relations. He has spent his entire term in office praising democracy, denouncing dictatorship, and promising to use American power to further his goals. But despite all of this, Bush has repeatedly sided with Beijing over Taiwan and warned Taiwan not to attempt secession, a more anti-Taiwanese statement than any ever made by an American president. That's why, despite Bush's speeches on liberty and his meeting with the Dalai Lama, Beijing is largely content with the administration. On the issue it cares about, Bush has been its ally. Beijing and Washington are wise to try to cooperate. Great power conflict is something the world has not seen since the Cold War. If it were to return, all the troubles we worry about now, terrorism, Iran, North Korea, would pale in comparison. It would mean arms races, border conflicts, rivalries among allies and client states, local conflicts, and perhaps more. The onward movement of economic and political modernization worldwide would slow, if not cease. Even without these dire scenarios, China will complicate existing power relations. Were the United States and the European Union to adopt fundamentally differing attitudes towards the rise of China, for example, it would put permanent strains on the Western alliance that would make tensions over Iraq look like a minor spat. A serious U.S.-Chinese rivalry would define the new age and turn it away from integration, trade, and globalization. There is a group of Americans, made up chiefly of neoconservatives and some Pentagon officials, that has been sounding the alarms about the Chinese threat, speaking of it largely in military terms. But the facts do not support their case. China is certainly expanding its military, with a defense budget that has been growing 10% or more a year, but it is still spending a fraction of what America does, at most 10% of the Pentagon's annual bill. The United States has 12 nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can each field 85 attack jets. China's naval engineers are still working on their first. China has 20 nuclear missiles that could reach U.S. shores, according to Pentagon estimates, but these small and cumbersome weapons are inherently vulnerable to a preemptive strike. The United States, by comparison, has around 9,000 intact nuclear warheads and around 5,000 strategic warheads. The Chinese understand how lopsided the military balance is. The China challenge, accordingly, will not look like another Soviet Union, with Beijing straining to keep pace in military terms. China is more likely to remain an asymmetrical superpower. It is already exploring and developing ways to complicate and erode American military supremacy, such as space and internet-based technology. Even more importantly, it will use its economic strength and its political skills to achieve its objectives without having to resort to military force. China does not want to invade and occupy Taiwan. It is more likely to keep undermining the Taiwanese independence movement, slowly accumulating advantage and wearing out the opponent. In a paper titled The Beijing Consensus, which draws heavily on interviews with leading Chinese officials and academics, Joshua Cooper Ramo provides a fascinating picture of China's new foreign policy. Rather than building a U.S.-style power, bristling with arms and intolerant of others' worldviews, he writes, China's emerging power is based on the example of their own model, the strength of their economic system, and their rigid defense of national sovereignty. Ramo describes an elite that understands that their country's rising power and less interventionist style make it an attractive partner, especially in a world in which the United States is seen as an overbearing hegemon. The goal for China is not conflict, but the avoidance of conflict, he writes. True success in strategic issues involves manipulating a situation so effectively that the outcome is inevitably in favor of Chinese interests. This emerges from the oldest Chinese strategic thinker, Sun Tzu, who argued that every battle is won or lost before it is ever fought. The United States understands how to handle a traditional military political advance. After all, this was the nature of the Soviet threat and the Nazi rise to power. The United States has a conceptual framework, as well as the tools, weapons, aid packages, alliances, with which to confront such an advance. Were China to push its weight around, anger its neighbors, and frighten the world, Washington would be able to respond with a set of effective policies that would take advantage of the natural balancing process by which Japan, India, Australia, and Vietnam, and perhaps others, would come together to limit China's emerging power. But what if China adheres to its asymmetrical strategy? What if it gradually expands its economic ties, acts calmly and moderately, and slowly enlarges its sphere of influence, seeking only greater weight, friendship, and influence in the world? What if it slowly pushes Washington onto the sidelines in Asia, in an effort to wear out America's patience and endurance? What if it quietly positions itself as the alternative to a hectoring and arrogant America. How will America cope with such a scenario? A kind of Cold War, but this time with a vibrant market society, with the world's largest population, a nation that is not showcasing a hopeless model of state socialism or squandering its power in pointless military interventions. This is a new challenge for the United States, one it has not tackled before and for which it is largely unprepared. In thinking through how to approach China, American political elites have fixed their gaze on another rising power, close to and close on the heels of China, India. Chapter 5. The Ally. In the fall of 1982, I took an Air India flight from Bombay's Santa Cruz Airport to go to college in the United States. The preceding decade had been a rough one in India, marked by mass protests, riots, secessionist movements, insurgencies, and the suspension of democracy. Underneath it all was a dismal economy, one that combined meager growth with ever-worsening inflation. Economic growth barely outpaced population growth. It would have taken the average Indian 57 years to double his income, given the rate of increase in per capita GDP at the time. Many talented and ambitious Indians believed that their only real future lay in leaving the country. Over 75% of the graduates of the Indian Institutes of Technology in the 1980s emigrated to America. The decades since 1997 could not have been more different. India has been peaceful, stable, and prosperous. The fires of secession and militant nationalism have died down. National and state governments changed hands without incident. There was even a thaw in the perennially tense relations with Pakistan. And underpinning it all was the transformation of the Indian economy, which grew at 6.9% over the entire decade and 8.5% in the second half of it. If this latter rate can be sustained, the average Indian will double his income in less than 10 years. Already, the cumulative effect of this new economics is apparent. More Indians have moved out of poverty in the last decade than in the preceding 50 years. The world has taken note. Every year at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, there is a national star, one country that stands out in the gathering of global leaders because of a particularly smart prime minister or finance minister or a compelling tale of reform. In the 12 years that I've been going to Davos, no country has so captured the imagination of the conference or dominated the conversation as India did in 2006. It goes well beyond one conference. The world is courting India as never before. Foreign leaders are now flocking to New Delhi, pledging to form deeper and stronger relations with the once exotic land. Yet most foreign observers are still unsure of what to make of India's rise to prominence. Will it become the next China? And what would that mean economically and politically? Will a richer India bump up against China? Will it look on the United States as an ally? Is there such a thing as a Hindu worldview? Perplexed foreigners might be comforted to know that Indians themselves remain unsure of the answers to these questions. India is too full of exuberance right now for much serious reflection. Exuberance worked well enough at the World Economic Forum. As you got off the plane in Zurich, you saw large billboards extolling "Incredible India." The town of Davos itself was plastered with signs. "World's fastest growing free market democracy," proclaimed the local buses. When you got to your room, you found a pashmina shawl and an iPod shuffle loaded with Bollywood songs, gifts from the Indian delegation. When you entered the meeting rooms, you were likely to hear an Indian voice, one of dozens of CEOs of world-class Indian companies in attendance. And then there were the government officials, India's dream team, all intelligent and articulate, and all intent on selling their country. The forum's main social event was an Indian extravaganza, with a bevy of Indian beauties dancing to pulsating Hindi tunes against an electric blue Taj Mahal. The impeccably dressed chairman of the forum, Klaus Schwab, donned a colorful Indian turban and shawl, nibbled on chicken tikka, and talked up the country's prospects with Michael Dell. India everywhere, said the logo, and it was. The success of this marketing strategy ensured that it was used again and again. On the 60th anniversary of India's independence, New York was overrun with glamorous concerts, galas, champagne receptions, and seminars celebrating the country's cultural, political, and economic success. The slogan India at 60 reflected the driving force behind it, India's technology companies. The event contrasted markedly with the 50th anniversary celebrations 10 years earlier, which culminated in a dull reception at the Indian consulate with fruit juice only because of the Gandhian taboo on alcohol, and a speech extolling India's diversity. Of course, today's jazzy campaigns wouldn't work if there were no substance behind them. Over the past 15 years, India has been the second fastest growing country in the world, behind only China, and it seems on track to continue this high-octane growth for the next decade. Like China's, its sheer size, 1 billion people, means that once on the move, the country casts a long shadow across the globe. While China's rise is already here and palpable, India's is still more a tale of the future. Its per capita GDP is still only $960, but that future is coming into sharp focus. The Goldman Sachs BRICS study projects that by 2015, India's economy will be equal to the size of Italy's, and by 2020, will have caught up to Britain's. By 2040, India will boast the world's third largest economy. By 2050, its per capita income will have risen to 20 times its current level. Predictions like these are a treacherous business, and trends often peter out. But still, it's worth noting that India's current growth rate is much higher than the study assumes, and crucially, the country has a promising demographic profile. As the industrial world ages, India will continue to have lots of young people, in other words, workers. China faces a youth gap because of its successful one-child policies. India faces a youth bulge because, ironically, its own family planning policies of the past failed. The lesson here is that all social engineering has unintended consequences. If demography is destiny, India's future is secure. Even the here and now is impressive. India's poverty rate is half what it was 20 years ago. Its private sector is astonishingly vibrant, posting gains of 15, 20, and 25% year after year. The private sector's strength goes well beyond just outsourcing firms like Infosys, the main association of many in the United States with the Indian economy. The Tata Group is a far-flung conglomerate that makes everything from cars and steel to software and consulting systems. In 2006, its revenues rose from $17.8 billion to $22 billion, a 23% gain. The more dynamic Reliance Industries, India's largest company, saw its profits double between 2004 and 2006. The total revenues of the auto parts business, made up of hundreds of small companies, grew from under $6 billion in 2003 to more than $15 billion in 2007. Over the next 3 years, General Motors alone will import $1 billion worth of Indian-made auto parts. And India now has more billionaires than any other Asian country, and most of them are self-made. Bottoms up. At this point, anyone who has actually been to India will probably be puzzled. India, he or she would ask, with its dilapidated airports, crumbling roads, vast slums, and impoverished villages, are you talking about that India? Yes, that too is India. The country might have several Silicon Valleys, but it also has three Nigerias within it. That is more than 300 million people living on less than a dollar a day. It is home to 40% of the world's poor and has the world's second largest HIV-positive population. But even if the India of poverty and disease is the familiar India, the moving picture is more telling than the snapshot. India is changing. Mass poverty persists, but the new economic vigor is stirring things up everywhere. You can feel it even in the slums. To many visitors, India does not look pretty. Western businessmen go to India expecting it to be the next China. It will never be that. China's growth is overseen by a powerful government. Beijing decides that the country needs new airports, 8-lane highways, gleaming industrial parks, and they are built within months. It courts multinationals and provides them with permits and facilities within days. One American CEO recalled how Chinese officials took him to a site they proposed for his new and very large facility. It was central, well located, and met almost all his criteria, except that it was filled with existing buildings and people, making up a small township. The CEO pointed that out to his host. The official smiled and said, "Oh, don't worry, they won't be here in 18 months. And they weren't. India does not have a government that can or will move people for the sake of foreign investors. New Delhi and Mumbai do not have the gleaming infrastructure of Beijing and Shanghai, nor do any of India's cities have the controlled urbanization of China's cities. When I asked the Chief Minister of India's most industrialized state, Vilasrao Deshmukh, whether India could learn something from the Chinese planned model of city development, he replied, "Yes, but within limits. China has often required that people have proof of a job before they can move to a city. This ensures that they don't get millions of job seekers who crowd into slums ringing around the city. I can't do that. The Constitution of India guarantees freedom of movement. If somebody wants to come and look for a job in Mumbai, he's free to do so." India's growth is taking place not because of the government, but despite it. It is not top-down, but bottom-up, messy, chaotic, and largely unplanned. The country's key advantages are a genuine private sector, established rights of property and contract, independent courts, and the rule of law, even if it is often abused. India's private sector is the backbone of its growth. In China, private companies did not exist 20 years ago. In India, many date back 100 years, and somehow they overcome obstacles, cut through red tape, bypass bad infrastructure, and make a buck. If they cannot export large goods because of bad highways and ports, they export software and services, things you can send over wires rather than roads. Gurcharan Das, the former CEO of Procter & Gamble in India, quips, "The government sleeps at night and the economy grows." The most striking characteristic of India today is its human capital, a vast and growing population of entrepreneurs, managers, and business-savvy individuals. They are increasing in number, faster than anyone might have imagined, in part because they have easy access to the language of modernity, English. Unwittingly, Britain's bequest of the English language might prove to be its most consequential legacy. Because of it, India's managerial and entrepreneurial class is intimately familiar with Western business trends, with no need for translators or cultural guides. They read about computers, management theory, marketing strategy, and the latest innovations in science and technology. They speak globalization fluently. The result is a country that looks like no other developing nation. India's GDP is 50% services, 25% industry, and 25% agriculture. The only other countries that fit this profile are Portugal and Greece, middle-income countries that have passed through the first stages of mass industrialization and are entering the post-industrial economy. India is behind such economies in manufacturing and agriculture, but ahead of them in services, a combination that no one could have planned. The role of the consumer in India's growth has been similarly surprising. Most Asian success stories have been driven by government measures that force the people to save, producing growth through capital accumulation and market-friendly policies. In India, the consumer is king. Young Indian professionals don't wait to buy a house at the end of their lives with savings. They take out mortgages. The credit card industry is growing at 35% a year. Personal consumption makes up a staggering 67% of GDP in India, much higher than in China, which is 42%, or any other Asian country. The only country in the world where consumption is higher is America at 70%. While Indian infrastructure is improving and further additions and renovations to the country's airports, highways, and ports are planned, India will not look like China. Democracy may bring certain advantages for long-term development, but autocratic governments are able to plan and execute major infrastructure projects with unrivaled efficiency. This is apparent whether one compares China with India or with Britain. The architect Norman Foster pointed out to me that in the time it took for the environmental review process for one new building at Heathrow, Terminal 5, he will have built, start to finish, the entire new Beijing airport, which is larger than all five of Heathrow's terminals combined. Yet even if great infrastructure pleases foreign travelers and investors and signals a country on the move, its economic impact can be exaggerated. When China was growing at its fastest in the 1980s and early 1990s, it had terrible roads, bridges, and airports, far worse than India does today. Even in the developed world, the country with the best infrastructure does not always win. France has trains and roads that gleam next to America's creaky system, but it's the U.S. economy that has edged ahead for the last three decades. A vibrant private sector can deliver extraordinary growth, even when traveling on bad roads. Some scholars argue that India's path has distinct advantages. MIT's Yasheng Huang points out that Indian companies use their capital far more efficiently than Chinese companies, in part because they do not have access to almost unlimited supplies of it. They benchmark to global standards and are better managed than Chinese firms. Despite starting its reforms later and thus being earlier in the development cycle, India has produced many more world-class companies than China, including Tata, Infosys, Ranbaxy, and Reliance. And its advantage is even more apparent at the lower levels. Every year, Japan awards the coveted Deming Prize for managerial innovation. Over the last 5 years, they have been awarded more often to Indian companies than to firms from any other country, including Japan. India's financial sector is at least as transparent and efficient as any in developing Asia, that is, excluding Singapore and Hong Kong. The statistics don't capture the shift in mentality, says Uday Kotak, the founder of a booming financial services firm. The India I grew up in is another country. The young people whom I work with today are just so much more confident and excited about what they can do here. The old assumption that made in India means second rate is disappearing. Indian companies are buying stakes in Western companies because they think they can do a better job of managing them. Indian investment in Britain in 2006 and 2007 was larger than British investment in India. And it's not just business. Urban India is bursting with enthusiasm. Fashion designers, writers, and artists talk about extending their influence across the globe. Bollywood movie stars are growing their audience from its domestic base of 500 million by winning new fans outside of India. Cricket players are working on revamping the game to attract crowds abroad. It's as if hundreds of millions of people had suddenly discovered the keys to unlock their potential. As a famous Indian once put it, a moment comes, which comes but rarely in history, when we step out from the old to the new, when an age ends, and when the soul of a nation, long suppressed, finds utterance. Those words, which Indians of a certain generation know by heart, was spoken by the country's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, just after midnight on August 15, 1947, when Britain transferred power to India's Constituent Assembly. Nehru was referring to the birth of India as an independent state. What is happening today is the birth of India as an independent society. Boisterous, colorful, open, vibrant, and above all, ready for change. India is diverging not only from its own past, but also from the paths of other countries in Asia. It is not a quiet, controlled, quasi-authoritarian country that is slowly opening up according to plan. It is a noisy democracy that has finally empowered its people economically. Indian newspapers reflect this shift. For decades, their pages were dominated by affairs of the state, usually written in cryptic insider's jargon. PM to propose CWC expansion at AICC meet. They reported on the workings of the government, major political parties, and bureaucratic bodies. A small elite understood them, everyone else pretended to. Today, Indian papers are booming, a rare oasis of growth for print journalism, and overflowing with stories about businessmen, technological fads, fashion designers, shopping malls, and of course Bollywood, which now makes more movies a year than Hollywood. Indian television has exploded, with new channels seeming to spring up every month. Even in the news business, the number and variety are bewildering. By 2006, India had almost 24 all-news channels. There's more here than just glitz and glamour. Consider the response to the 2005 tsunami. In the past, the only response in India worth noting would have been the government's, which would have involved little more than coordinating foreign aid. In 2005, New Delhi refused offers of help from abroad, one more indication of growing national pride. But the most striking shift was elsewhere. Within 2 weeks after the tidal wave hit, Indians had privately donated $80 million to the relief effort. 4 years earlier, in 2001, it had taken a year to collect the same amount of money after a massive earthquake in Gujarat. Private philanthropy in Asia has typically been a thin stream. When the rich give, they give to temples and holy men. But that seems to be changing. One of India's richest men, Azim Premji, a technology multi-billionaire, has said he will leave the bulk of his fortune in a foundation, much as Bill Gates has. Anil Agarwal, another self-made billionaire, has announced plans to donate $1 billion towards setting up a new private university in Orissa, one of India's poorest regions. Private and non-profit groups are getting involved in healthcare and education, taking on functions that should be the responsibility of the state. By some measures, more than 25% of schools and 80% of the healthcare system in India now lie outside the state sector. The software firm Infosys Technologies has started its own corporate foundation to provide rural areas with hospitals, orphanages, classrooms, and school books. All this sounds familiar. In one key regard, India, one of the poorest countries in the world, looks strikingly similar to the wealthiest one, the United States of America. In both places, society has asserted its dominance over the state. Will that formula prove as successful in India as it has been in America? Can society fill in for the state? The necessity for government. The Indian state is often maligned, but on one front, it has been a roaring success. India's democracy is truly extraordinary. Despite its poverty, India has sustained democratic government for almost 60 years. If you ask the question, what will India look like politically in 25 years? The answer is obvious. As it does today, a democracy. Democracy makes for populism, pandering, and delays, but it also makes for long-term stability. India's political system owes much to the institutions put in place by the British over 200 years ago. In many other parts of Asia and in Africa, the British were a relatively temporary presence. They were in India for centuries. They saw it as the jewel in their imperial crown and built lasting institutions of government throughout the country. Courts, universities, administrative agencies. But perhaps even more importantly, India got very lucky with the vehicle of its independence, the Congress Party, and its first generation of post-independence leaders, who nurtured the best traditions of the British and drew on older Indian customs to reinforce them. Men like Jawaharlal Nehru may not have gotten their economics right, but they understood political freedom and how to secure it. The fact that a political and institutional framework already exists is an important strength for India. Of course, pervasive corruption and political patronage have corroded many of these institutions, in some cases to the point of making them unrecognizable. India has a remarkably modern administrative structure, in theory. It has courts, bureaucracies, and agencies with the right makeup, mandate, and independence, in theory. But whatever the abuses of power, this basic structure brings tremendous advantages. India has not had to invent an independent central bank. It already had one. It will not need to create independent courts. It can simply clean up the ones it has. And some of India's agencies, like its National Election Commission, are already honest, efficient, and widely respected. If the Indian state has succeeded on some dimensions, however, it has failed on many others. In the 1950s and 1960s, India tried to modernize by creating a mixed economic model between capitalism and communism. The product was a shackled and overregulated private sector and a massively inefficient and corrupt public sector. The results were poor, and in the 1970s, as India became more socialist, they became disastrous. In 1960, India's per capita GDP was higher than China's and 70% that of South Korea. Today, it is less than two-fifths that of China. South Korea's is 20 times larger. Perhaps most depressing is India's score on the United Nations Human Development Index, which gauges countries not just by income, but by health, literacy, and other such measures as well. India ranks 128th out of 177 countries, behind Syria, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, and the Dominican Republic. Female literacy is a shockingly low 48%. Despite mountains of rhetoric about helping the poor, India's government has done little for them, even when compared with the governments of many other poor countries. It has made too few investments in human beings, in their health and education, and when budgeted, the money has rarely been well spent. In the 1980s, Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi estimated that of every 10 rupees that was supposed to be spent on the poor, just one actually got to the person in need. Can these problems be blamed on democracy? Not entirely. Bad policies and administration produce failure, whether pursued by dictators or by democrats. Still, certain aspects of democracy can prove problematic, especially in a country with rampant poverty, feudalism, and illiteracy. Democracy in India too often means not the will of the majority, but the will of organized minorities. Landowners, powerful castes, rich farmers, government unions, local thugs. Nearly a fifth of the members of the Indian Parliament have been accused of crimes including embezzlement, rape, and murder. These organized minorities are richer than most of their countrymen, and they plunder the state's coffers to stay that way. India's Communist Party, for example, campaigns not for economic growth to benefit the very poor, but rather to maintain the relatively privileged condition of unionized workers and party apparatchiks. In fact, India's left wing is largely opposed to the policies that have finally reduced mass poverty. In all this ideological and political posturing, the interests of the 800 million Indians who earn less than $2 a day often fall through the cracks. But democracy can also right wrongs, as India's democracy has done on one crucial issue. In the 1990s, an ugly Hindu nationalism raged through the country and captured its politics through the Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP. It whipped up Hindu animosities against Muslims and also exploited the stark political reality that India's Muslim population is disempowered almost by definition. Since those areas of British India where Muslims were a majority became Pakistan and Bangladesh, Muslims almost everywhere in India are a weak minority. Over time, though, the BJP's incitement of hatred and violence produced a backlash. A thoroughly secular government came to power in 2004, headed by Manmohan Singh, the former finance minister who opened up India's economy in the summer of 1991. In an act of wisdom and restraint, Sonia Gandhi, who led the ruling coalition to victory in the polls, chose to appoint Singh prime minister rather than take the job herself. As a result, quite unexpectedly, India's chaotic and often corrupt democratic system produced for its head of government a man of immense intelligence, unimpeachable integrity, and deep experience. Singh, an Oxford PhD, had already run the country's central bank, planning ministry, and finance ministry. His breadth, depth, and decency as a person are unmatched by any Indian prime minister since Nehru. But Singh's stellar credentials and character haven't helped the country much. The pace of India's reforms has disappointed its well-wishers. Ever since the initial burst of reforms in the 1990s, governments in both New Delhi and in the states have been cautious in eliminating subsidies and protections. Nor have they pushed new pro-growth initiatives, such as the creation of large economic zones or infrastructure projects. They have sometimes proposed new programs that look suspiciously like programs that have had little success in the past. But this paralysis cannot be blamed entirely on the government. A change in the ruling party will not bring about Chinese-style reforms. Economic reforms produce growth, but they also produce dislocation. And those hurt by change always protest more loudly than those who benefit. Add to that the messy politics of coalitions, someone somewhere can always block a proposed reform, and you have a recipe for slow movement, one step forward and three quarters of a step back. It is the price of democracy. Despite the lack of far-reaching new policies, there is a quiet determination in both the public and the private sectors to keep moving forward. Behind the cacophony of Indian politics, there is actually a broad consensus on policy among the major players. The major opposition party, the BJP, criticizes the Singh government on two fronts, economic reforms and pro-Americanism. In fact, it took exactly the same positions as Singh when it was in government. The arrow may be moving slowly, but it moves in the right direction. Every week in India, one reads about a new set of regulations being eased or permissions being eliminated. These stealth reforms, too small to draw vigorous opposition from the unreconstructed left, add up. And India's pro-reform constituency keeps growing. The middle class is already 300 million strong. Urban India is not all of India, but it is a large and influential chunk of it. And the vibrancy of the Indian private sector compensates in some measure for the stasis in the state sector. In any event, there is no other way. Democracy is India's destiny. A country so diverse and complex cannot really be governed any other way. The task for a smart Indian politician is to use democracy to the country's advantage. In some ways, this is already happening. The government has recently begun investing in rural education and health and is focusing on improving agricultural productivity. Good economics can sometimes make for good politics, or at least that is the Indian hope. Democracy has also been broadened since 1993 to give villages greater voice in their affairs. Village councils must reserve 33% of their seats for women, and there are now 1 million elected women in villages across the country, giving them a platform from which to demand better education and healthcare. Freedom of information is also being expanded in the hope that people will insist on better government from their local leaders and administrators. It is bottom-up development, with society pushing the state. Will the state respond? Built during the British Raj, massively expanded in India's socialist era, it is filled with bureaucrats who are in love with their petty powers and privileges. They are joined by politicians who enjoy the power of patronage. Still others are wedded to ideas of third world socialism and solidarity. In these views, they are joined by many intellectuals and journalists who are all well-schooled in the latest radical ideas, circa 1968, when they were in college. As India changes, these old elites are being threatened and redoubling their efforts. Many in India's ruling class are uncomfortable in the modern, open, commercial society they see growing around them. In the end, government matters. Even India's great success, its private companies, could not flourish without a well-regulated stock market and a financial system that has transparency, adjudication, and enforcement, all government functions. The booming telecommunications industry was created by intelligent government deregulation and re-regulation. The Indian Institutes of Technology were created by the state. The private sector cannot solve India's AIDS crisis or its rural education shortfalls, or its environmental problems. Most Indians, particularly the poor, have only miserable interactions with their government. They find it inefficient or corrupt, and often both. That might be why anti-incumbent sentiment has been the strongest force in Indian elections over the last 3 decades. Indians keep throwing the bums out, hope that government will get better. And voters have a point. If India's governance does not improve, the country will never fully achieve its potential. This is perhaps the central paradox of India today. Its society is open, eager, and confident, ready to take on the world. But its state, its ruling class, is hesitant, cautious, and suspicious of the changing realities around it. Nowhere is this tension more obvious than in the realm of foreign policy, the increasingly large and important task of determining how India should fit into the new world.